Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for November 2015. They include psychiatric symptoms in Wilson's disease and interactions between inflammation and depression. We'll also report on possible biomarkers for schizophrenia. And two large prospective longitudinal studies clarify temporal relationships in psychiatric disorders. One of them looked at the relation of smoking status to later development of schizophrenia, and the other long-term study tracked the development of post-traumatic stress disorder in Army service members following traumatic brain injury. We'll conclude with reflections on working in the Amish culture. The article on traumatic brain injury has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at the top of our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll start the November highlights with our clinical case conference. It's about psychiatric symptoms in Wilson's disease. Paula Zimbrium and Michael Shilsky note that a vast range of psychiatric symptoms have been described in these patients. In fact, the illness has been called a great masquerader. Cases have been reported of patients carrying a diagnosis of schizophrenia for years before being diagnosed with Wilson's disease. The authors present the case of a woman whose Wilson's disease was already diagnosed. She was started on a combination of the copper chelator, trientine, and zinc. She soon developed colitis, which was thought to be a side effect of the trientine. To treat the colitis, prednisone was started and trientine was discontinued. Within days, the patient began having insomnia, increased energy, and delusions of thought control. She had been staying up at night and claimed to be a famous movie star. She was taken to the emergency room and was admitted to the medical service. A presumptive diagnosis of steroid-induced psychosis was made. Prednisone was tapered off and antipsychotic treatment was started. The patient developed significant neck dystonia after a single dose of olanzapine, so treatment was switched to quetiapine. When the dose was increased to 50 milligrams a day, she developed orthostatic hypotension and sedation. Over several days, the quetiapine was titrated to 75 milligrams, and her psychiatric condition improved. However, at home, the patient continued to be disorganized and tangential. She developed paranoid delusions and became aggressive, and she was readmitted. She had been off steroids for 6 weeks and had continued the zinc for Wilson's disease. Trientine treatment for the Wilson's disease was resumed, and the patient was transferred to the psychiatric unit. Quetiapine was discontinued, and haloperidol was initiated at 20 milligrams a day. But the patient developed Parkinsonian symptoms. She also developed bloody diarrhea and was returned to the medicine service. Trientine-induced colitis was confirmed by endoscopy. She was started on prednisone without worsening of her psychosis, and quetiapine was reintroduced. Her paranoia began to resolve, although her thought process remained tangential. Over the next month, quetiapine was continued, and clonazepam was prescribed for insomnia. The thought disorder and Parkinsonian symptoms slowly resolved. 9 months after the start of the psychotic symptoms, the patient showed no evidence of psychosis and had resumed working. Her copper and ceruloplasmin levels were consistent with treated Wilson's disease. The quetiapine and clonazepam were eventually tapered and discontinued. To the psychiatric consultants in this case, the patient's initial presentation suggested steroid-induced mania. But several factors suggest that steroids weren't the primary cause of her illness. She didn't have pressured speech, flight of ideas, or psychomotor agitation. And the psychosis persisted months after the steroids were discontinued. Also, there were no side effects with the second steroid challenge. In addition, the patient didn't have any cognitive deficits, which occur in most cases of steroid-induced neuropsychiatric side effects. Little is known about the treatment or the prognosis of psychiatric symptoms in Wilson's disease. The primary treatment of Wilson's disease is directed at removal of pathological copper deposition by chelation therapy or treatment with zinc. This alone leads to an improvement in psychiatric symptoms. However, psychotropic medication or psychotherapy is sometimes also used to address specific psychiatric presentations. The case report illustrates three important aspects of treatment. First is sensitivity to antipsychotic medications. This case supports the practice of selecting antipsychotics that are less likely to cause extrapyramidal symptoms, such as quetiapine, and titrating the dosage slowly. A second important issue is the setting where treatment is provided for psychiatric symptoms. Patients with Wilson's disease may have active medical problems requiring prompt management, and psychiatric units often aren't equipped for it. Often, a psychiatrist in a consultative role follows patients with Wilson's disease when they're hospitalized on a medical unit. Another important factor is the duration and goal of treatment. For this patient, remission of psychiatric symptoms was achieved after 9 months of treatment. This slow recovery may have been due to the slow reduction of copper levels in the brain, but it may also be attributable to the slow adjustments of her psychotropic medications due to her sensitivity. Full remission was maintained for 3 years without psychotropic medications while she continued treatment for Wilson's disease. Close ongoing observation is advocated to identify when the psychiatric symptoms resolve and the disease markers are normalized. At that time, attempts should be made to discontinue the psychotropic medications to reduce side effects. In the context of effective medical therapy for Wilson's disease, its association with irreversible cognitive decline is no longer the rule. This case supports the notion that the goal of treatment for patients with Wilson's disease who develop psychotic symptoms is total remission and return to previous functioning. Next up is a review of the interactions between inflammation and depression. Inflammation plays a key role in the pathogenesis of depression for a subset of depressed individuals. Depression also primes larger cytokine responses to stressors and pathogens that do not appear to habituate. Janice, Kecolt, Glazer, and colleagues focus on how and for whom these links exist, and on how these questions inform treatment decisions. Meta-analyses have highlighted pro-inflammatory cytokine differences between patients with major depressive disorder and controls. These cytokines include interleukin-6 or IL-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha, and C-reactive protein or CRP. Clinical samples show stronger associations than do community samples. A causal pathway is supported by findings that higher levels of IL-6 and CRP predicted the subsequent development of depressive symptoms. Prospective studies also showed that depression predicted later IL-6 and CRP levels. Cytokines induce depressive symptoms through diverse mechanisms. Peripherally released cytokines send signals via molecular, cellular, and neural routes. Ultimately, they reach the brain and enhance CNS inflammation. Stressors and pathogens can lead to exaggerated or prolonged inflammatory responses when combined with predisposing factors, such as childhood adversity and obesity. Disturbed sleep and pain are additional independent accelerators for depression and inflammation, and they can also act in tandem. The gut microbiota also interact with inflammation and depression through neuroendocrine and endocrine signaling pathways. Physical and psychological stressors can alter the gut microbiota's composition and metabolic activities. In turn, signals produced by the gut microbiota can affect the brain and emotional responses. Depression and inflammation are also affected by diet, its quality, quantity, and timing. Fish oil, in particular, has generated considerable interest. Meta-analyses of randomized controlled trials have reached different conclusions about the efficacy of omega-3 fatty acids for treatment of depression. They suggest that improvement from omega-3 fatty acids is more likely in patients with greater inflammation or depression at baseline. Physically active individuals have lower levels of inflammatory biomarkers than their sedentary counterparts. But two reviews of randomized controlled trials concluded that exercise produces little or no change in inflammatory markers in healthy people who don't lose weight. However, the initial inflammatory profile made a difference in some studies. The antidepressant effects of exercise were greater in those who had higher baseline levels of inflammatory markers. Stress and depression can also act synergistically with obesity to potentiate larger inflammatory responses. These, in turn, could further fuel depression. In addition to higher baseline levels of inflammation, the data suggests that obesity also confers risk by generating larger inflammatory responses to stress or pathogens. Thus, when inflammation and depression occur together, treating them in tandem may enhance recovery and reduce the risk of recurrence. The antidepressant effects of anti-inflammatories may be magnified in patients with comorbid pain-related or inflammatory disorders. These cover a wide spectrum, from psoriasis to cardiovascular disease to obesity. Evaluating the risk factors for heightened inflammation can be an indirect way to evaluate a patient's inflammatory phenotype. For objective confirmation, the optimal strategy would be to determine treatment based on a set of biomarkers. IL-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha, and CRP have the strongest relationships with depression. A meta-analysis of the effects of antidepressant medication on cytokines showed that only SSRIs appeared to affect cytokine production. Cognitive behavioral therapy may also reduce inflammation. Other interventions can also have benefit. Alcohol dependence and smoking are often comorbid with depression, and both have notable inflammatory consequences. Successful treatment of either can produce positive changes in both inflammation and depression. Weight loss, dietary change, exercise, and some integrative medicine interventions can also provide significant long-term benefits. Improvements in pain and sleep can enhance treatment outcomes and reduce the risk for recurrent depression. CBT has well-documented efficacy in the long-term remission of insomnia. And for pain and related problems, CBT can improve pain, physical disability, and mood. In addition, a randomized study with rheumatoid arthritis patients found that declines in IL-6 levels were larger with CBT than with mindfulness meditation or an education condition. Now we'll look at the relationship between smoking and schizophrenia. Kenneth Kendler and colleagues looked at the temporal relationship of smoking and schizophrenia in two large cohorts of men and women in Sweden. Genetic influences were also examined. One of the study cohorts contained more than 1 million women from the Swedish Birth Register. Their smoking status was evaluated during prenatal care at an average age of 27. A smaller cohort of men was made up of Army recruits with an average age of 18. In each cohort, the level of smoking was categorized as none, light, or heavy. Data for members of the two cohorts were matched to national healthcare data to see whether smoking was related to a subsequent diagnosis of schizophrenia or non-affective psychosis. The average follow-up periods were 18 years for the women and 8 years for the men. The first question posed by the investigators was, does smoking predict subsequent risk for schizophrenia? The hazard ratios for first-onset schizophrenia were elevated for both light smoking and heavy smoking, and the magnitudes of the associations were similar in the female and male cohorts. To see whether these results arise from smoking that begins during the prodromal phase of illness, the analysis was repeated with differing requirements for the minimum time period between smoking assessment and schizophrenia onset. The association between smoking and schizophrenia did not decline with longer buffer periods. Another research question was whether there's a dose-response relationship in the association between smoking and schizophrenia. Compared to the risk of schizophrenia in non-smokers, the risk was more than twice as high in light smokers and more than 3 times as high in heavy smokers. Another measure of smoking severity was explored in the female cohort. Just before pregnancy, and in both the early and late stages, severity of smoking was rated on a 5-point scale. Women in Category 1 only smoked lightly before becoming pregnant, and they quit before their first midwife visit. By contrast, those in Category 5 were smoking heavily at weeks 30 to 32. Women in Categories 4 and 5 had a significantly increased risk for schizophrenia during follow-up. For non-affective psychosis, increased risk was seen for women in all but the lowest smoking category. Confounders were also examined. Both socioeconomic status and drug abuse are plausible confounders that might be responsible for large proportions of the relationship between smoking and schizophrenia. When the analysis controlled for both community-level and family-level socioeconomic status and for drug abuse, there were relatively modest declines in the relationship in both the female and male cohorts. Another possible influence on the association between smoking and schizophrenia is a familial or genetic risk factor. To examine this possibility, analyses looked at the risk of non-affective psychosis in relatives with varying degrees of affinity. The analyses focused on results for non-affective psychosis rather than schizophrenia because the latter was less common. A portion of the association between smoking and non-affective psychosis was attributable to common familial or genetic risk factors. So the findings suggest that the causes of the link between smoking and schizophrenia are complex. Shared familial genetic risk factors, and to a lesser extent, other epidemiological confounders contribute to the association. Most challenging, however, is the evidence for the potential importance of a causal pathway from smoking to risk for schizophrenia. Another prospective study examined the effect of traumatic brain injury during military deployment on post-traumatic stress disorder and other psychiatric conditions. A few previous studies have demonstrated an association between traumatic brain injury, or TBI, and subsequent PTSD. But some questions remain unanswered. These relate to the specificity of the association and whether very mild TBI has a salient impact on subsequent mental health. Murray Stein and colleagues addressed these questions in a military setting as part of the Army study to assess risk and resilience in service members. Baseline and follow-up data were gathered from more than 4,000 Army soldiers who completed self-report questionnaires at several time points. The baseline evaluation was before their deployment to Afghanistan. Follow-up data were collected after they returned from Afghanistan, within a month of their return, approximately 3 months later, and 9 months later. Probable TBI was determined by a question about the number of head, neck, or blast injuries, followed by questions about alteration or loss of consciousness, and about lapse of memory. Each respondent was categorized as having no TBI or having probable TBI with a severity level of very mild, mild, or more than mild. The severity ratings were based on loss of consciousness and lapse in memory. Psychiatric diagnoses were based on a self-administered, computerized version of the Composite International Diagnostic Interview Screening Scales and a screening version of the PTSD checklist. Analyses of the relationship between TBI and the diagnoses were adjusted for numerous factors that might influence the risk for TBI or might have independent associations with the outcomes, such as prior mental health status and severity of deployment stress. Exposure to a mild or very mild TBI during deployment was reported by 18% of the soldiers. Only 1% reported a TBI that was more than mild. TBI acquired during deployment was associated with a substantially higher risk for having PTSD at 3 and 9 months after deployment. In addition, there was a dose-response relationship. TBI categorized as more than mild was associated with the greatest elevation of risk for PTSD. The odds ratios reflected approximately 4 times greater risk relative to no TBI. Mild TBI conveyed an intermediate elevation of risk, with odds ratios suggesting a near doubling of risk. Very mild TBI was also related to a greater odds of PTSD, but the risk elevation was smaller and was statistically significant only at 1 follow-up point. Other mental disorders were also related to TBI during deployment. Post-deployment major depressive episode and generalized anxiety disorder were both significantly associated with deployment-acquired TBI. On the other hand, the data did not clearly demonstrate an increase in risk for suicidality related to TBI. The association with suicidality at 3 months after deployment was nearly significant, but it was no longer evident by the 9-month follow-up. Other characteristics were also related to post-deployment PTSD, depression, anxiety disorders, or suicidality. The most important of these was greater severity of deployment-related stress. Now we'll look at schizophrenia biomarkers. MicroRNAs are a class of small, non-coding RNAs that can inactivate a target mRNA sequence. Increasing evidence shows that they take part in many biological processes, including cell proliferation, differentiation, migration, and apoptosis. It's been suggested that 70% of known microRNAs are expressed in the CNS. Some of them are brain-specific or brain-region-specific. Altered microRNA levels have been found in the CSF and postmortem brain of schizophrenia patients, but no circulating microRNAs have been identified that might be used as schizophrenia biomarkers in a clinical context. Circulating levels are highly associated with diabetes, cancer, and immunological diseases, but so far there's been no systematic research on circulating microRNAs in psychiatric diseases. Thus, Hui Wei and colleagues analyzed microRNA levels in patients with schizophrenia, patients with other psychiatric disorders, and healthy subjects. More than 500 patients with schizophrenia were included in 2 cohorts. First, global plasma microRNAs were profiled in a test cohort of schizophrenia patients and healthy subjects. 2 different techniques were used for screening, and findings were confirmed by quantitative reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction assays. The process identified 2 microRNAs that were upregulated in schizophrenia. These were validated in an independent cohort. In addition to schizophrenia patients in healthy subjects, this cohort contained patients with non-schizophrenia psychiatric disorders, including depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, and other conditions. The pattern of altered microRNA expression was confirmed in the schizophrenia group. It did not appear in the patients with other psychiatric disorders. To clarify whether the altered levels of the two plasma microRNAs were state-dependent, a follow-up study was carried out on patients treated with antipsychotics. About 100 patients completed the one-year follow-up. More than half achieved the remission criteria. The levels of the two plasma microRNAs declined significantly in these patients, but not in those without remission. The findings are discussed in an editorial by Murray Kanz. He describes the potential of microRNAs as biomarkers. They are actively secreted from a variety of tissues and provide a protective microenvironment. Extracellular microRNAs can emerge from anywhere in the body, particularly immunocytes, neurons, and glia. So they potentially report on the status of remote systems. MicroRNAs have emerged as important regulators of brain development and function, and they appear to be involved in neurological and neuropsychiatric disorders. Several groups have observed neuropathological changes in the expression of microRNAs in postmortem studies of schizophrenia. Several target genes of these microRNAs have potential significance to schizophrenia and brain function, suggesting that elevated levels may have relevant neurobehavioral implications. Neuropsychiatric syndromes such as schizophrenia consist of complex clusters of behavioral phenotypes with relatively diffuse and inconsistent neuropathology. Informative molecular biomarkers, including circulating microRNAs, could find a multiplicity of applications in both clinical and research environments. MicroRNAs have several advantages, including their proximity to the genetic basis of complex traits, in some cases directly linked. They're also involved in epigenetic programming that arises through the culmination of environmental interaction. As functional entities with direct and immediate influence in cell biology, they may reflect the status of biological systems better than do coding transcripts, which are subject to post-transcriptional and post-translational regulation. Finally, microRNAs are surprisingly stable in extracellular fluids and are therefore relatively accessible molecules that can report on the prevailing state of deep tissue changes. Now we'll conclude with our introspections feature. Carla Campanella became a psychiatrist for an Amish mental health clinic. The psychiatrist before her retired, and before he left, he briefed her in the many ways that she would need to adapt her practice methods to the Amish culture. Some patients only had a telephone in a shed down the lane. Others attended MedCheck visits with an entourage of numerous family members, including toddlers crawling around the room, as well as community members along for support. The first real clash of cultures occurred during a routine MedCheck visit. The patient was a very depressed young Amish man. Fortunately, he was accompanied by a support person from the community who was experienced in what were referred to as English ways. Dr. Campanella states, "I had just completed what I, in my hubris, felt was a masterful combination of motivational interviewing, behavioral activation, and CBT designed to address some dysfunctional thoughts and behaviors that were preventing him from fully recovering. At the end of my intervention, he looked at me and said, 'I just need to give up.' I was taken aback, not just by the narcissistic injury, but also because those words coming from a very depressed young man made me concerned that he was heading down the path to hopelessness and suicide. Thrown off course, I lost some professional footing and said the first thing that came to my mind, "No, don't give up." The young man looked confused. Thankfully, the English savvy support person stepped in at that moment, and he explained that in Amish culture, to give up means to accept or submit to something. So we were able to return to setting some concrete goals and adjusting the meds, and we finished the visit on a positive note. Since that interaction, I've encountered the expression to give up many times in working with the Amish. It's a phrase gravid with meaning. In the Amish community, authority is central. So in this phrase, the giving, the acquiescing, or accepting is upward toward the authority over them. To the outsider, the constant focus on submission to multiple rules and leaders seems onerous. Within the community, however, submission is most often seen as a source of identity, security, and support. The benefits of submission are especially true for those with mental illness. The way the church leaders and community members provide a network of support and accountability is heartwarming. Within this structure, people are supervised in taking their medications and meeting goals in activities of daily living. This allows Amish people with serious mental illness to have a family, hold a job, and remain an integral part of the community. This concludes our audio highlights of the November issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles, including author affiliations and financial disclosures. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psychpsych.org. Next month, our topics will include managing alcohol use disorder in patients requiring liver transplant, extend and release guanfacine for hyperactivity in children with autism spectrum disorder, preventing anxiety disorders in offspring of anxious parents, pregnancy complications following exposure to SSRIs or maternal psychiatric disorder, and the effect of attention training on attention bias variability and PTSD symptoms. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.